Coming up, with same-sex marriage now legal across the country, Kim Lawton looks at how growing social acceptance of LGBT issues poses new challenges for evangelicals. And Bob Abernathy talks with Britain's former chief rabbi, Jonathan Sacks, about religion and violence. Plus, Fred de Sam Lazaro visits the Basilica of Our Lady of Guadalupe in Mexico, the most popular Catholic pilgrimage destination in the world.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Welcome. I'm Hari Srinivasan, sitting in for Bob Abernathy. It's good to have you with us. Days before this past week's Republican debate, two GOP presidential candidates took their cases directly to evangelical leaders. At a conference of Southern Baptist pastors in Nashville, Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio spoke about how faith influences their politics. Rubio's comments were in a pre-recorded conversation. In a live discussion with Southern Baptist leader Russell Moore, Bush covered many topics, including the Supreme Court's June decision to legalize same-sex marriage nationwide. Bush said those who disagree with the ruling should not be marginalized.
We don't want to create an environment of discrimination against people based on sexual orientation, but we certainly don't want to discriminate against people that believe that their faith drives their actions and the things that they consider to be important.
Democratic frontrunner Hillary Clinton declined an invitation to speak at the event. Jewish and liberal Democratic candidate Bernie Sanders made a surprising announcement that in September he will speak at Liberty University, the conservative evangelical college founded by the late Reverend Jerry Falwell. Faith-based groups are among those welcoming the administration's new plan to dramatically cut carbon emissions from U.S. power plants. President Obama unveiled the final version of the measure at the White House. He cited Pope Francis's recent encyclical on the environment, saying that, quote, taking a stand against climate change is a moral obligation. A spokesman for the U.S. Catholic bishops called the plan an important step forward to protect the health of all people, especially the poor and vulnerable. The group Interfaith Power and Light said its member congregations would work to ensure the plan is implemented. Also this week, President Obama continued trying to rally support for the nuclear deal with Iran. During a speech at American University, he promised that Iran will be caught if it tries to cheat. The president hosted American Jewish leaders at the White House to address concerns about the agreement. Meanwhile, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was part of a live webcast trying to persuade American Jews to oppose the deal. He said it would endanger the security of Israel. Faith leaders from across the spectrum are participating in the NAACP's 40-day March for Racial Justice that began in Selma, Alabama, and will end in Washington, D.C. The marchers spoke of continuing inequalities in America, including incidents of police violence against blacks over the past year. The march comes amid the one-year anniversary of the Ferguson shooting death of 18-year-old Michael Brown by a white police officer. Several churches and other religious groups have planned special activities to mark that event. Now, a special report. As we saw again this week, with the election season cranking up, religious conservatives remain a key constituency, especially for the GOP. In the wake of the Supreme Court's decision on same-sex marriage, evangelical Christians remain among the staunchest opponents of the practice. But Kim Lawton looks at how growing acceptance of LGBT issues in American society is posing new challenges for the evangelical community.
Even though they say we have fallen, doesn't mean that I won't do it twice.
This is Grammy-nominated singer-songwriter Jennifer Knapp. She's leading a workshop on faith and sexuality at a conference co-sponsored by Vanderbilt Divinity School. It's a vastly different gig from the days when Knapp was considered one of the top artists in the very conservative contemporary Christian music scene. In 2010, after a long hiatus, Knapp publicly came out as a lesbian. She says reactions from some in her evangelical audience were deeply painful.
Burn in hell, you're going to hell, you know, there's something wrong with you and your faith. You can't, you're not a Christian. You've never been a real Christian. Anything that you've ever contributed to the faith community is a lie.
But she has received support from evangelicals as well. And as society increasingly accepts LGBT issues, Knapp says she sees more and more evangelicals reexamining their views.
I think it's an error to write off faith communities as incapable and as negative to the LGBT story. In fact, quite the opposite. I think there are people there that are ready to love and embrace and shift the balance of what we see as the LGBT acceptance in our community, and from a really beautiful level, from a level of faith and spirituality.
Evangelicals have been among the staunchest opponents of homosexuality. They cite the Bible.
The traditional understanding of how the Bible teaches sexuality is that sex is something between one man and one woman in a monogamous marriage, and that anything outside of that is considered to be sin against the laws of God.
J.D. Greer is pastor of the Summit Church, a megachurch in Raleigh-Durham. He doesn't believe large numbers of evangelicals are changing their minds, but he acknowledges homosexuality can be a tough issue.
It's difficult to talk about because people immediately make assumptions about you and how you feel. If you say, well, this is wrong, then there's assumptions as to, you know, all of that's a spirit of hate. It's something I think is challenging for pastors to reckon with, wanting to be faithful to what the Bible teaches, what they believe the Bible teaches, and then also be loving toward people and embracing.
It seems every single week there's another flashpoint somewhere around the country over this set of issues. Not to mention the personal questions of how families grapple with these sorts of questions and how churches articulate our beliefs on those things. I think it's one of the most pressing issues we face right now.
Russell Moore is president of the Southern Baptist Convention's Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission and currently one of the most prominent evangelical voices on gay issues.
Christianity has existed in cultures that were very hostile to the way that we see the world. And so American culture is changing. We simply have to hold on to the truths that we believe have been articulated to us. And we have to do it in a way that is balancing both truth and grace.
Numbers can vary depending on how evangelical is defined, but strong opposition to gay marriage persists. A 2014 poll by the Public Religion Research Institute found that almost 70% of white evangelicals opposed same-sex marriage, the highest of any religious group. However, the same poll found that 43% of millennial evangelicals, ages 18 to 33, would support it. At this year's annual conference of the Gospel Coalition, several sessions were devoted to discussing how best to confront the wider culture.
I think some younger evangelicals have grown up even not even knowing or not understanding that Christianity requires you to push back against the world.
Still, the coalition's Colin Hansen is among those arguing for a different tone in the debate.
What might look courageous to you might look bigoted to somebody else. So our challenge is in our courage to look like Jesus looked, which is also fully compassionate and loving toward those, even those he was confronting.
One of the things that we teach at our church is you have to love the person you're talking to even more than you love your position on this issue. It doesn't mean you compromise your position on this issue. It just means that your love for the person goes beyond that.
While some LGBT advocates welcome a new, kinder tone from evangelicals, many say without a change in message, it's not enough.
It's sort of like a trick, right? It feels like a trick. Someone will feel safe to come out or share their story, and, you know, they won't feel safe after they've come out, or they'll be, you know, told to not act on those desires, or that celibacy is the only option for them.
Brandi Daniels says after she came out in 2006, she was no longer welcome at her evangelical grad school. Now she studies queer theology at Vanderbilt. She says denying LGBT people the right to marriage is tantamount to withholding spiritual benefits from them.
By denying, you know, same-sex couples that opportunity, we're denying them
an opportunity to experience and participate in God's love for us and for one another.
Some are urging conservative Christians to reconsider their interpretations of Scripture, particularly passages on sexuality by the Apostle Paul. Matthew Vines is author of God and the Gay Christian.
We don't see in any kind of consistent or widespread or prominent way in ancient literature long-term, faithful, monogamous same-sex relationships between equal status adult partners. And so what I'm saying is we just need to recognize that Paul is not speaking to the question of same-sex marriage, nor is he speaking to the question of gay Christians.
Vines grew up in the evangelical world. In 2012, he posted a YouTube video of a more than one-hour long scholarly lecture where he argued that it is possible to affirm the full authority of the Bible while also affirming committed same-sex relationships.
What the New Testament teaches about marriage is that it is fundamentally about a covenantal commitment to one spouse. It's about self-sacrificial covenant love that reflects God's love for us in Christ. Same-sex couples are just as capable of living out that kind of a relationship as are opposite-sex couples.
Most evangelicals are not persuaded.
God created and designed marriage and sexuality, the one flesh union of a man and a woman, to picture the gospel of Jesus Christ. We didn't make these doctrines up. We received them from Jesus and the apostles, and we don't have any authority to change them.
Are a majority of evangelicals that ready to change their positions right now? No. But some of them are, and all you need is some people who are willing to do that, and then to give them the biblical basis and argument to support that position. And if they can stay in their churches after changing their position, it starts to significantly shift the dynamic.
Also hoping to shift the dynamic, Jennifer Knapp has started a group called Inside Out Faith, which encourages gay people of faith to share their stories, just as she has.
I think the challenge is for us to be able to be compassionate to one another, to try and let our particular views and our experiences not be things that are mandates that other people have to accept.
Greer agrees about the need for more compassion in the debate, but says evangelicals must have the right to stay true to their convictions, no matter how unpopular in the wider culture.
We want to respect your right to say what it is you think, but it's not fair for you to turn to us and say you don't get to express your viewpoint, because immediately, even though you agree with 2,000 years of church history and how Christians have interpreted it, what you were saying is out of the bounds of civil society.
I'm Kim Lawton reporting.
We have a profile now of the former chief rabbi of Great Britain, Jonathan Sacks. Sacks is a learned philosopher and Orthodox rabbi, the author of 25 books with 16 honorary degrees. He's a newspaper columnist and a popular broadcaster who was knighted by Queen Elizabeth. He's also a member of the House of Lords. All that and a sense of humor. Bob Abernathy sat down with him.
The key voices at these moments have been the survivors.
Rabbi Sacks is teaching and lecturing in the U.S. this year. He was the keynote speaker at the Jewish Federation's annual General Assembly and then taught a class where he recalled his knighthood ceremony.
When you receive a knighthood, you have to kneel. And Jews don't kneel. Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, we do, but any other time, no. So they provide this little thing which you hold on to, this little rail, so that you can incline yourself a little without actually kneeling. At which point, as I'm sure you know, the Queen turned to Prince Philip and said, "Why is this knight different from all other knights?"
That's knight with a K. As Britain's chief rabbi for 22 years, Sacks got to know many of the world's leaders. He was widely respected and honored. And then he retired to lead a global religious response to global religious violence.
I'm afraid that religion causes violence whenever we confuse piety and power. Those are two completely different things. So when I seek power in the name of piety, I do great harm. I injure God's world. Fundamentalism, which is what we're talking about here in any religion,
is always the product of fear. And I believe we have to allow faith to conquer fear. Somehow we have to let the better angels of our nature prevail over the fear that turns people into enemies. With religious movements, it's extremely hard to make peace because peace demands a virtue called compromise, which to a religious mind is not a virtue but a vice.
And learning to respect each other's religions, Jewish, Christian, and Muslim, will take how long?
I set myself to kind of educate the educators of the next generation. And I don't think there's any shortcut. There's no quick fix here. You don't suddenly turn radicals into moderates. You have to educate a generation.
That means we're looking at these atrocities for, what, another generation or two?
I suspect so.
Sachs insists that his message applies not only to Jews, but to others as well.
I fight for the right of Christians to live their faith without fear anywhere in the world. But I need you Christians to fight for the right of Jews to live without fear anywhere in the world.
Sachs saw for himself the damage violent religious extremism can do when he visited Ground Zero in New York after 9/11.
Murder of the innocent is forbidden in Islam. Suicide is forbidden in Islam. To be a suicide bomber is categorically forbidden in Islamic law. So you have here some religious radicals who are doing in the name of Islam what the leading teachers of Islam now and throughout the Muslim past have ruled to be categorically forbidden.
Sachs's hope that education can prevent violence is challenged by the Nazi Holocaust, which was supported by many of Europe's most cultured and learned people.
The more you study the Holocaust, the less you understand. I've spent a lifetime studying it, and I still cannot understand. There were string quartets playing in Auschwitz-Birkenau while 1.25 million human beings were gassed, burned, and turned to ash. What happened in Auschwitz, in the Holocaust, was a terrible demonstration of the limits of civilization to civilize if we do not fear God and see His image in every human person.
Now the internet and social media are spreading anti-Semitism.
The end result is that hostility anywhere can be communicated everywhere. I wouldn't say it's people are suddenly starting to hate Jews. It's just that a few people have learned how you can communicate hate very effectively and very widely.
Is anything like that happening in the United States?
I can't see how the United States can remain immune to it. Nobody is immune to it.
Sachs has deep praise for the ability of the U.S. over its history to combine religion and freedom.
If you want proof that you can be deeply religious and yet create a society that respects the freedom of the other, then you have to look here in America.
Sachs calls this a historic moment, challenging religious leaders to prevent the violent misuse of their own and everyone else's faith.
I think when the world, in the Middle East, in parts of Africa, parts of Asia, are tearing themselves apart by people fighting wars of religion of the kind we haven't seen since the 17th century, to get up and say to be a Jew is to be true to your faith, and at the same time a blessing to others regardless of their faith, if people took that one sentence to heart, it would change the world.
Which is just what Rabbi Sachs, in so-called retirement, is trying to do.
All On our calendar, August 15th is the Feast of the Assumption, when Roman Catholics, Eastern Orthodox, and some other Christians commemorate the belief that the Virgin Mary was bodily taken into heaven at the end of her earthly life. Shrines dedicated to Mary are too numerous to count. One of them is the most popular Catholic pilgrimage destination in the world, the Our Lady of Guadalupe Basilica in Mexico. The basilica honors the tradition of Mary's appearance to a Native American peasant in the 1500s. Fred de Sam Lazaro visited there and saw the devotion of the pilgrims.
The masses start at 6 a.m. and continue uninterrupted until 9 p.m., 7 days a week at the Basilica of Our Lady of Guadalupe. This building, erected in the 1970s, is the fourth structure in a complex that dates back 500 years, when believers say Mary, the mother of Jesus, appeared here.
Since the apparitions of Our Lady that happened in 1531, Our Lady has accompanied the nation across the foundation, through the independence movement, then through the revolution movement.
All told, some 20 million people come here each year, some on their knees for the last leg of the pilgrimage. They come from across Latin America and the world, though most are from Mexico.
For me, she's everything, the most important saint in our religion. She's our mother.
We want to thank her for our new baby.
I want to thank her for my baby sister.
She helps me study.
She fell 5 months ago and couldn't walk. Our Lady helped her recover.
Her story, some say legend, is richly displayed in statues and art around the complex. In 1531, the Virgin Mary appeared to Juan Diego, an Indian who'd been converted to Christianity by the conquering Spanish. She asked that a chapel be built here. The request was relayed to the bishop, who in turn asked Juan Diego to bring back a sign to confirm the divine apparition.
And the sign that was given to him were Castilian roses. But that was not only the sign. From the clear white tilma of Juan Diego, which was the robe, we'll say a coat, he was bringing the roses inside the coat. When he opened the tilma, the image that you're looking in back of me, the original one, appeared.
That original cloth and image, kept behind glass at the basilica's altar, has endured now for 500 years, the symbol, church leaders say, of unity relevant until today.
The Virgin, she was a woman, a Jew, the mother of Jesus, Catholic but with a Muslim name. Everything about her symbolizes unity.
And unity was sorely needed at the bloody birth of this nation in 1521 after the Spanish conquered it from the Aztecs.
It was not only a military conquest, it was a religious and cultural conquest also. She represented comfort for the people who were humiliated and conquered by the conquistadors.
But just exactly who she was is an interesting question, says religion scholar Bernardo Barranco. He says one reason the Virgin of Guadalupe may have worked as a unifying or pacifying force is that this was the site of a temple to Tonantzin, a mother figure among Aztec deities long before the Spanish arrived. In New Spain, as Mexico was first called, the Virgin's image, cloaked in Indian garments, may well have represented Tonantzin, albeit Christianized. Through the years, questions have been raised about the authenticity of the Guadalupe story. Some scholars note that the first written record of Juan Diego's existence is found more than 100 years after the 1531 apparition.
I'm not only a religious person, I'm also a scientist, a chemist, and some of the evidence we have is not easy to explain away.
In 2002, Juan Diego was canonized by Pope John Paul II, a pontiff long revered in Mexico.
The biggest question was he making a saint out of someone that didn't exist? Historically, they can't prove the non-existence of Juan Diego, and the religious can't prove his existence. It ended up being a leap of faith.
And in the end, he says it doesn't matter if the apparition really occurred. 90% of Mexicans have an unshakable faith in the Virgin, whose shrine is the Catholic world's top pilgrimage destination. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, this is Fred DeSamlazaro in Mexico City.
That's our program for now. I'm Hari Srinivasan. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook and watch us anytime on the PBS app for iPhones and iPads. There's also much more on our website where you can listen to or watch every program. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you, scenes from Hiroshima, Japan, where bells tolled this week to mark the 70th anniversary of the bombing of the city in World War II.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Be more. PBS.